listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library. Welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. We're your hosts. I'm Abby.
And I'm also Abby. We are librarians at the Central Library.
In this episode, we'll hear a recording of a virtual panel that took place last month featuring a discussion on virtual learning with homeschooling tips.
But before we get to that, we've got book chat. Okay, book chat. Abby, what do you have to talk to us about today?
I read Making Our Way Home, The Great Migration and the Black American Dream by Blair Amani, and has illustrations by Rochelle Baker. And so this, as the title suggests, is an illustrated history of the Great Migration. And so for listeners who might not be familiar with that term, that's a period in U.S. history when African Americans moved in great numbers out of the South and into other areas of the country, with like large populations settling in cities like Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, Harlem, and New York. And so this mass movement was spurred by a lot of factors. Economic opportunity in new cities, but also the desire to flee kind of racial terror violence in the wake of Reconstruction. So I picked this up because I love learning from illustrated nonfiction, graphic novels, and other things. This isn't a graphic novel. It is because the content falls heavily in favor of text, but there are illustrations that really kind of bring it to life. So the way this is written, it covers the period from roughly 1910 to 1979. So it takes a broad look at the Great Migration and incorporates what's sometimes called the Second Great Migration, which starts around World War II. So the author, Amani, argues that these two waves of migration are really just kind of bumps in the same movement. She does this really incredible job of providing a robust look at African American history during the last century. And she makes it really accessible. One of the things that she does is bring in, more well-known historical figures and ties in the work of specific cultural and political figures into this timeline of the Great Migration. So she brings in the artists of the Harlem Renaissance, but also, the soldiers who were part of the Harlem Hellfighters. She brings it up through the civil rights movement and brings in, well-known figures from that, including Malcolm X, Ella Baker, and others. And then she comes as recent as really like the height of the Black Panther Party and up through the creation of hip hop. So it's this really incredible job of tracing how this movement of people out of the South, Black people, Black Americans out of the South and into other parts of the country, led to cultural and political developments throughout the country. And what I appreciated about it the most is how it ties the Great Migration into the larger context of US history. So I don't know if you had this experience, but for me, learning US history, it was always kind of trumped, right? You would like learn, well, this is what happened in these years. And then also now we're gonna do a unit on the civil rights movement, right? And so I was like, it took me years to realize like, oh, the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War and anti-war movement, those were at the same time. Right? Yeah. It's just like, that was never taught to me that way. So I really appreciate the way that this book and books kind of like this really help give a more holistic experience and understanding of US history. So I did love this and I would recommend it for anyone interested in African American history specifically, or more broadly, just 20th century U.S. history, because it's got a lot of great information and it's done in a really engaging way.
That sounds really neat. I have two questions for you.
Yes.
One is, so this is a nonfiction book. Yes. And does it operate in the way of kind of tracking a few main stories, or is it almost like, because you noted the well-known figures who maybe right. Many of us will be familiar with, but I assume that there are also some figures who have kind of faded into history, maybe we didn't
Absolutely.
Know about before. Are all of those stories kind of taking equal weight, or are we looking at one person kind of through time, mostly?
That is a great question. So it's kind of both. Mm-hmm. So you meet a lot of people, and some of them, maybe just because of when they were alive or when they were active in whatever art or political context they were, they really only appear in one part of this kind of robust timeline. But then you have figures like Malcolm X, who appears and then appears again later. And so you're sort of tracing his political transformation as you're following the latter part of the Great Migration.
Okay. Would you say that it's kind of classified as more of a narrative nonfiction, like reads like a novel, or reads more like a kind of a reference book, like you can flip through, look at the pictures, skip around?
Yeah, I think it's more like a reference book, but somehow, you know, still has bits of narrative in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can definitely skip around, but I recommend reading it cover to cover just for that more kind of, just for the historical context, I think, right? Yeah. What you get from the beginning of the Great Migration impacts the later parts, so.
Cool. And it's for adults?
It is, but I think it's accessible to teens. Probably even, maybe not late middle school, but definitely high school aged.
Cool. That sounds good. I actually also was planning to talk about a historical book this time, although my book is historical fiction, and this is a book, I will say that I'm not completely finished with it. I'm about 3/4 of the way done with it, mm-hmm. but I'm reading it for the Brown Baggers Book Club, so sure. We can link to that in the show notes if anyone is interested in learning more, but it's a book club that meets once a month. And right now, of course, it's meeting virtually. So November, we're going to be discussing The Tattooist of Auschwitz by Heather Morris. And it was kind of interesting because if you remember on our first podcast, I said, oh, you know, as a kid, I read like the kid kind of historical fiction Holocaust novels. So I was excited to read this. And like I said, I'm about 3/4 of the way through. But the main premise of the story is we're following this man, Lale, and he is in the concentration camp, and he finds himself pretty early on in the novel with this position of relative privilege, where he is the tattooist. So he, with that job, he has a room to himself, he has extra rations, and one of the most interesting things to me is the fact that he develops this almost relationship with the Nazis and the guards and the people who are imprisoning him, but he is on like a first name basis with them, and he can talk to them, he can ask them favors. They also talk to him and ask him for advice, ask him for favors. So that's one way that Heather Morris starts to kind of explore this idea of maybe some Jews who are feeling guilt or feeling shame or feeling confusion and uncertainty in their relationship with kind of the whole Nazi agenda, because he feels like he's helping the enemy by tattooing the numbers, even though it's his job and he's doing it to survive. So there's an interesting dynamic there and a push and pull. The other really big part of this book, obviously, is that it's a love story. So it's a love at first sight love story. Lale meets Gita as he's tattooing her number on her arm, and they fall instantly in love. And then they meet up throughout the course of the novel. They spend time together and they, fall in love. And while I'm not finished with the book, it's one of those books where you know how it ends. So really the driving factor that keeps you reading is you want to know how it gets there. And you want to know kind of what twists and turns, but you know that they survive and they end up together. Well, if you, read the book, or read even just the inside cover. So you're just figuring out how it's all going to work out. And my thoughts on the book so far are, I like it. I don't love it. It's not my favorite Holocaust book that I've read. I think some of my biggest qualms with it are just the love factor. It's a true story. They, I guess it's a real love because they, you know, got married after this, after they were able to escape and have a child together. But the way it's written, it almost just feels like it's fake. If I didn't know it was real, I would think it was just way too good to be true and way too kind of almost Disney feeling. Mm. You know, just some of the writing is like, they fall in love, but we don't get to see why. And maybe part of the problem is that Heather Morris is going off of interviews and maybe she doesn't want to create any story that's not necessarily there by Lale, but it is historical fiction. Like, she takes some liberties with it. So I would love to just see more of their relationship, because right now what I get is a lot of, they love each other, you're my love, you know, I'm going to marry you, we're going to have a life after this, but you don't really see why they care for each other. And while I do enjoy the story, I'm not even necessarily drawn to the characters. So it's like, I couldn't tell you necessarily why Geeta is an appealing woman or why Lale is like such a great catch. So maybe it will be fleshed out more in like the last quarter of the book. I'm not sure. But one thing that's interesting to note is that if you have read The Tattooist of Auschwitz, because it's a few years old, and if you liked it, you might be interested in reading Silka's Journey, which is a new book that we have, and it was just released this year. But it covers the story of Silka, who's another character in the novel. She's a supporting character.
Oh, cool.
Has a very interesting story. So I might try to read Silka's Journey as well, just to kind of compare and to see how it goes. But
does Lale ever discuss with Geeta his like feelings of complicity or his, you know, have you seen that yet? Is that something they discussed? Do you get to hear like how Geeta feels about it or her thoughts?
Well, that is another area that I wish she would dive into more, because, you know, the Holocaust is all about, you know, persecution and murder because of someone's faith. And as soon as Lale gets to the camp, he kind of loses his faith. Mm-hmm. We learn later in the book, Geeta and Lale have this discussion about faith. She says, I fear you, that you've lost your faith. And he says, yes, I did. I lost it the first night I was here. And she says that faith is still important to her. Mm-hmm. And he says that he will support her. And again, it's almost just like this very easy conversation. It's, you know, so quick and done, easy. And I wish that maybe it's not true to Lale. Maybe it was a very simple conversation, but I feel like it would be a more interesting novel if there was some tension there, you know, if we had some emotional scenes that were showing how Lale feels about being Jewish or losing his faith, because that to me is something that I wish was explored more too.
That's interesting. How would you say that just that, like, the love story aspect and the tension with his role as the tattooist, would you say those are the two kind of features that separate it from the Holocaust focused historical fiction you've read in the past?
Yes, I would say that those are the most unique kind of factors, or that's what makes it feel the most unique in my mind. Because I personally hadn't really read a story where somebody was in this relative position of power, like a Jew, you know, a prisoner. You know, I had read stories of where they had survived, but it was more just like luck. You know, they were the lucky few who survived. So that was neat. And the most similar thing that I've read as far as like the love is, and sorry, actually I didn't read it, but it's a movie and Life is Beautiful, which is in Italian. And it's a great movie that is about love, but it's a family love. So it's a dad and he loves his wife who is not Jewish, and they have a child who is Jewish with the dad. Mm-hmm. But the dad ends up in the concentration camp with his young son, and he loves his son so much that he wants to protect him from this in whatever way possible. So he almost turns it into a game up until the very end. And it's a very sweet, love that they share. And he also loves the wife, and she ends up in the concentration camp as well because she follows them there. So I've seen it in the movie, Life is Beautiful, and I would recommend the movie. It was a nice movie, but
excellent. It's hard when you first talk about a romance set in a concentration camp to not like cringe at that idea, but I think it's really important to talk about the way like people were living. They were going through life in a concentration camp, so it makes sense that they're experiencing all of the things that you experience in life, even in this horrific situation. So it's interesting.
Yeah. And really, honestly, if I read it again, I might have a different take, because maybe it's just that I really haven't read a Holocaust book since I was a kid. So it's more, I'm used to these stories that are just telling you it was terrible. Like, you know, they were murdered, they were gassed, they were shot and killed. And so to see these people kind of existing in ordinary life, almost not an ordinary life, but they're working, they're living. And it's kind of like almost unsettling to me of, I almost feel like she's not making it seem as terrible as it was, but it could just be that I've kind of gotten into the adult genre, and it's, you have to realize that some were in these camps for years, and while they were living a really horrific life, they did still have life. So
yeah,
that's a really good point.
Next, we'll hear a recording of a virtual panel that took place last month, featuring a discussion with homeschooling and virtual learning tips. Panelists include Sheila Krobach, Maggie Williams, and Jennifer Ferguson, who are experienced in homeschooling and virtual education and whose professional backgrounds lend valuable expertise to the discussion. Our colleague Wynn also joins the panel to discuss their own experience as a homeschooled learner.
Okay, well, hello. Thank you everyone for joining us for this program today on virtual learning and homeschooling. My name is Ann Lindberg, and I work at the Scottsville Library of the Jefferson Madison Regional Library as a children's specialist. Before I go over some logistics and introduce our panelists, I'd like to remind everyone that you can access all of our virtual programming on jmrl.org. This event and all JMRL events have been made possible by the incredible and generous support of the Friends of the Library. This program is also being recorded for inclusion on the JMRL YouTube channel. So if you'd like to rewatch this program or have a friend who couldn't attend, barring any major technical issues, we will try to get this posted in the next couple of days. And without further ado, I am very happy to introduce the following people who are here with us here today. So we're going to start with Wynn. Wynn Schell. Wynn is a reference librarian at JMRL and has worked as a librarian and archivist in various institutions around the country. They were homeschooled all the way through high school and went on to live in Mexico and Costa Rica on several academic scholarships. They graduated summa cum laude with degrees in both history and archaeology from the University of New Mexico, got their master's in library and information sciences from the University of Illinois, and are here to prove that homeschooling can work. Welcome, Wynn. Maggie Williams. Maggie has been homeschooling her two young children for many years, and through her experience, she has determined some of the best resources in academic areas such as teaching. Maggie and her family are nature enthusiasts and incorporate nature learning into their studies. Maggie is also a photographer who specializes in intimate parent photography. You can find more information about her work at maggiewilliamsservices.com. Welcome, Maggie. Jennifer Ferguson. Jennifer is a former teacher and a former school librarian. She has spent the last two decades homeschooling her four children and has many tips for simultaneously juggling the academic needs of different aged children. Jennifer's children have also attended school at various points, and she is adept at facilitating this transition from homeschooling to school and vice versa. Jennifer is currently organizing a homeschool consulting service that will be available soon. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Sheila Krobach. Sheila is the founder of Dot to Dot Speech and works with children of all ages using a whole child approach to speech language therapy service. She is also a certified yoga teacher and incorporates yoga into her treatment plans. Sheila has been in practice for over 2 decades and has owned her own practice for 12 years now. You can learn more about her services at dottodotspeech.com. She is also a mom to 2 children who are currently attending school virtually. Welcome, Sheila.
Thank you.
Okay, well, we're going to start. I have lots of questions, but this again is a conversation. So if at any point any of you want to jump in or add your own perspective, just feel free to do so. So I'm going to start with you, Jennifer. And I guess I'm going to start off with a more broad question. Like, why did you pursue homeschooling for your 4 children? What advantage did you see with that method of education?
It was probably multifaceted, many different reasons that came together. We love to travel, and we're lucky that we have parents on both sides, my husband's parents and my parents, who are pretty active in our lives and our kids' lives. And we're willing to travel with 4 kids in tow. and do really active things, you know, hiking in the West and heading overseas and things like that. So we were lucky to have that opportunity to take advantage of grandparents and time and pre-COVID when we when we could travel, move about the cabin a little more. So there was that piece that was super exciting. And I knew that traveling just in and of itself with your grandparents, you don't need any books. You know, you've got a lot of great stuff going on there. But I knew that it was a great opportunity to give them experiential background so that when they came to the books at school, they would say, oh, I've been to a castle, or I've, you know, seen John Muir's woods, things like that. So I was really excited to build up their experiential background. I do have one daughter who really benefited from this because she has a lot of kind of severe learning disabilities. And so for her, it was a super great advantage. But also, I knew that I wanted to just spend more time with my girls, just sitting on the couch reading great books. Yeah. And sometimes when kids are super busy going to school, there's not time to read all the great classics because they're busy doing other things. So I knew that I wanted to spend a lot of time with books. I mean, as a former librarian, you know, we have books everywhere, and we just wanted to roll around in them and and really experience them. So it gave us that opportunity to integrate all of our great books into what we were learning about and really have the time to reread lots of favorite classics and some, you know, and also contemporary, you know, things that were just super fun and cozy. So we spent a lot of time, that was kind of my main focus every time I homeschooled, was to integrate books, great books, and into the library. And we're so lucky to have JMRL in our backyard that lets us take huge stacks of books. And we would cart them home. It was a really great day. The library day was a great day for everybody.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maggie, you've also chosen homeschooling. What are your reasons for doing so, and what advantages do you see in homeschooling?
So I had never really intended on homeschooling. I graduated from public school system, and my mom is a special ed educator who has worked both publicly and privately. But when I started having children, circumstances kind of pushed me into a stay-at-home parent role, which I also hadn't ever planned on, but that's what our family needed. So when it came time to start considering education options for my kids, mm-hmm. It felt like more of an option. It mm-hmm. felt like something that I should pursue or at least consider since I was already in this position of being at home with them. Mm-hmm. Also, prior to having children, my last non-self-employed job was working within a public school system as a special ed teaching assistant. And I worked with this phenomenal educator who her whole heart was in her job, and she was amazing with the children. But I watched how even she kind of struggled to work within the requirements for like testing and getting everything done. And there were times where, you know, I was put in a position of having to help her juggle it, mm-hmm. Just so that she could meet all of the standards of children one-on-one. And, you know, and there was a very kind of rigid structure within the school system that I didn't necessarily want with my kids. I wanted to make sure that, you know, recess was more than 5 to 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. I wanted them to be able to have the experiential learning of learning through play. So all of that kind of pushed me into kind of testing the waters of homeschooling. And to be completely honest, it has been a lot of a struggle, a lot of learning, a lot of unlearning for myself, trying, you know, I wanted my children to have a more flexible learning environment, but coming from the public school system myself, kind of unlearning expectations and not putting that in my home. And this is the first year I can happily say, like, I feel like like we got it, we have a good rhythm, and you know, I'm really seeing some of what I see are advantages for my children for being mm-hmm. educated at home, and seeing how they're pulling things from lessons and books and connecting them with their outside play mm-hmm. and adventures. Mm-hmm. And also, like, we were considering public school for this year, to be completely honest, and COVID made that decision for me real easy. but one of the things I was struggling with, where it wasn't an automatic answer to put my kids in public school, was just one of my children has very particular learning needs, and I did not feel like they would thrive in a typical classroom setting. So, and that's one of the big reasons it wasn't a yes straight into public school sort of decision. And it's nice to be able to support them in the ways that they need.
Thank you, Maggie. Yeah, that's, I hear both you and Jennifer talking about time a lot too, like having that time with your kids and being able to, mm-hmm. Well, Sheila, now that we're in a world where basically all kids are learning at home, even if parents hadn't planned on homeschooling them, what I'm hearing most from parents I talk to is a sort of frustration because they're not used to homeschooling, and they're not used to structuring their kids' learning so much. So I guess my question is, what would you say to parents who feel overwhelmed because they're in a struggle with their child to get them to focus? And do you have any tips for creating a learning structure at home to get kids to learn outside of that sort of structure of school?
Oh my goodness, Anne, that's a huge, broad question. I will now spend the next 24 hours talking about that. Yeah. So I think the first thing that I guess there are a couple of first things I would want to say. The first thing is, I think that we have great parent and homeschool representatives here. But I also want to point out that virtual learning through the public schools or wherever your child's in school is different than homeschooling. And what I value in hearing the homeschool model and following some of those posts and blogs and learning a bit mm-hmm. about that is how do we mesh those things together, right? I haven't necessarily chosen the homeschool path for whatever reason, but now my child is schooling at home, and how can we take tips and knowledge from that model of homeschooling, but also recognize that it's a bit different. I'm going to guess if I say a lot different, probably Jennifer and Maggie and Wynn are going to nod their head. It's different, right? So we're not trying to make virtual school learning homeschooling, but I think there's a lot to gain from what does that homeschool experience offer, and how do parents do that, and how can we mesh those together? I also want to say that I would almost beg every parent to give themselves lots of grace, plenty of grace in these moments, because our experience this year for virtual school learning is not going to match a typical your child goes into the school building school year. And not only is it not going to match because of all of the circumstances, but it shouldn't match that, right? Parents are working at home while supporting their child virtually. They're balancing all the things that they might do typically once their child's in the school building with a child at home. I mean, if we could just even take the example, and I'm sure we've all been there. The minute I pick up the phone to make a call is when my children need me the most, right? That's now happening all the time for everybody. So we're balancing a lot. So I would just make sure that everyone's giving themselves a lot of grace in this period of time. I think that you, Anne, said it. You asked the question, your parents are wondering, how do I get my child to focus and attend? And I would argue that we don't make children focus and attend. And so I think that maybe the fundamental place, the place to start first is, and this is what I do in my own practice, and I appreciate the nod to the holistic, this very whole child idea, is that children don't learn and process information unless they're feeling that their social emotional needs are supported and unless they are in a state of regulation and their arousal is in the right place. So whether you are doing it in school, whether it's bath time, whether it's going to a medical appointment or a therapy appointment, whatever it is in life, none of us thrive if we are dysregulated, if we're feeling out of control. And so I think that's the place to start for everybody, that if your child is having a hard time focusing and attending, what do they need? And it's going to be very individualized, but what do they need to support their nervous system and to help them get to the place where they can focus and attend? And then what is their stamina and tolerance for that length of focus and attention before they need another reset? And part of that is dependent on us as the adults and parents, and kids co-regulate to us. So if we are feeling stressed and anxious and come on, I need you to get on the screen, I need you to do this right now, that is what our child is likely picking up on. And even if we can, for lack of a better word, make them sit there and look at the screen, their nervous system is likely not attending and processing and focusing, even if they're doing the physical piece that you've just asked them to do. So I think it's really, really important for us to remember that, and this is true not only at home, this is true at school too. And for my field of work, for what I'm doing, and as I'm working with families who are in this position and also have children with special learning needs and differences, is doing some talking now about, you know, do you think what you're seeing at home is different than what they experience at school? Or do you think just the circumstances surrounding it and the tools and strategies might be a little bit different? And how can we incorporate those at home? And part of the frustration and challenge there is that we feel we're on a very strict timeline. Synchronous learning is happening now, and children may not be ready now. And so finding that balance. So I think that's a lot of big abstract talk and theory, right? But the reality is that what do we do to get them ready and to match their sensory nervous system? And so I don't write, it's not a one size fits all, but I thought that, you know, it might be helpful to share maybe just a few, and you can tell me, is this a good time? A few, like, these are four things that you can be thinking about. This is a good time? Okay. So in the world of sensory motor and sensory regulation and nervous system and arousal and all these words that we're throwing out around this, in this world, we know that children, that all of us, I shouldn't even say children, all of us, we're all doing it right now, respond really well to oral motor and sensory input to their mouths and to deep proprioceptive input. So your child, if your child is needing to get organized and focused and ready to attend for that synchronous learning that is starting at 8:30 a.m., prior to that time, you want to do things to get their nervous system regulated, and for yourself too. So those things might include making sure that they have a really great breakfast with food tastes and textures that they really enjoy, sucking things through a straw to help them get organized, maybe starting your day with a little bit of yoga to get some deep pressure into their body, or maybe starting their day with a walk or a pillow fight or an obstacle course, right? Depending on where your child falls on that, I'm waking up and I'm transitioning into my day. So thinking about meeting their physical needs and their arousal and regulation needs, those are huge places to start. I also like to think about visual schedules and supporting children with visuals, because it allows for us as parents to set forth a plan for the day and stick by that. It doesn't have judgment in it. A visual schedule has no judgment. It's you can place it in front of your child and help them see what's coming to help them feel a little bit more control and also understand the transitions that are coming towards them. So I think that's a great tool to use along with what I've just talked about with waking their sensory system up. So helping them feel organized and somewhat in control and understanding what's coming at them. And then I'll throw this out there and we can go back to it. I'm a huge proponent of things that have to do with our breath work and how we set our nervous system up for success with our breath work. And that's like a whole nother, I feel like that's all of these are topics into themselves, but I'll end there because I know we want to move on to other areas, but those are sort of the places that I would look at to how do I help my child focus and attend. We're not going to make anyone focus and attend.
That's awesome.
So Sheila, when you're describing all those things, what pops into my head, I think Maggie as a mom and Wynn as a homeschooled kid at one point, I'm wondering if, like in our house, we did that. Like breakfast was kind of a big deal, which we probably couldn't have done, or we didn't do as well or as fully when my kids were in school, because you're just rushed. You know, you're on somebody else's time schedule. But with homeschooling, we could say we're all going to meet together and eat breakfast. You know, so the idea of, you know, being nourished and talking at the table a little bit. And my husband could join us before he went off to work. So it was kind of like our family, one of our family meal times. And it's interesting because it just felt very good to center everybody, yeah. You know, and then I could leave them at the breakfast table after our family time and clean the kitchen up or do what I needed to do, organize the things while they were still finishing eating. So they weren't rushed and I was still getting done what I needed to get done. And they weren't bugging me because they were eating, right. You know, and the idea of a walk also, and I'm sure Maggie, being a nature lover, has probably done this a lot in the morning. I mean, if you have a dog, you send the kids out to walk the dog, or you send the big sister out with the little sister to take a walk around the block. So, you know, putting your super amazing theories into real practice, you know, mm-hmm. It can be as simple as big sister takes little sister and the dog around the block, mm-hmm. or family meets for breakfast. And it doesn't mean you have to sit there for an hour. You know, you can start off with the whole family there for 15 minutes. And then dad leaves to go to work and mom cleans the kitchen and the kids are finishing food. Mm-hmm. And then there was one other thing when you talked about visual schedules. I totally agree, because you can kind of like throw the schedule under the bus. The schedule says, instead of mommy wants you to, or I'm telling you to, you can say, oh, look, the schedule says, you know, then yes. They're like, they're not mad at you. They're mad at the darn schedule, you know? It somehow has this amazing authority, right? Like the schedule on the refrigerator says we should be doing this, which then I'm sure Maggie and Wynn can comment on this too of their experiences, which I did find making lists for my kids super helpful. Mm-hmm. So we always had a list, you know, whether it was, you know, chores list or what we're going to do, morning work list, or once I met with them, here's your independent assignment list. And sometimes we would even, you know, with some kids, they needed time. So we would talk about, well, this is a pretty easy assignment because it's a review. So this one should only take you 10 minutes. But this reading is a bit pretty long chapter with tiny print. So this is going to take you 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, and we would negotiate the times together with each other. And I have to say that some of my kids really loved that. And I had one kid in particular who didn't, do not put a time on me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I also kind of had to negotiate that too with like, okay, the time thing, just, you know, it freaks her out to have the timer, you know, whereas other kids, they wanted the timer. Mm-hmm. So anyway, just putting some practical pieces onto your amazing theories. It was so interesting to hear you. And I would love to hear what Maggie and Wynn comment on those as well, what they experienced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting hearing your suggestions because I feel like we've put some of those into practice this year, and I've seen a big difference with my children. So, and I do want to say to anyone who is watching, it can feel really overwhelming to have like a lot of suggestions come in. And I know when I was trying to figure out our homeschool schedule, it's like, well, you should do this and this and this and this with your kids. And it's sometimes it still feels like there's not enough time. So like picking a few things that really resonate with you and your family to build into a regular kind of ritual, I think makes a difference, and it has for mine. So I wanted to share my morning ritual with our kids, which incorporates a lot of what Sheila was talking about, but we have breakfast together every morning, and it's not this long drawn out thing. We all start together, and as we sort of finish, you know, it takes like 15 minutes to eat. And then we move into our own separate ways. We've done it enough now that my kids have their morning responsibilities or chores, which they're expected to fulfill shortly after if they haven't done it already before breakfast. And then I give my kids some time to just play. And usually that involves them going outside. They're typically children who are outside before the sun's even up. But so giving them that freedom to choose, to feel in control before we start our official lessons. And as we get closer to school time, we do a short walk as a family through our neighborhood. They often ride their bikes. And then before we start our actual lessons, my kids and I kind of gather on the sofa, and we start off with doing some deep, quiet breaths. Right. Nothing really substantial, but sometimes I'll give them a visualization to think about. And we do that, and we go through an affirmation card set, and then we read a book. And that book usually reinforces whatever they're learning in science or history or their language arts program. And then that's when we move to our more official schoolwork, mm-hmm. that have lessons. And all of that, excluding breakfast, it only takes like half an hour, if that. And sometimes it ranges depending on how long the story is. But so it doesn't have to be this long, like, time commitment. But doing all of that, I have really seen a shift in my children in being more enthusiastic about starting school. It's not this thing that they dread so much. It's like, honestly, my youngest did not like that we were not doing our kind of a sofa routine on the weekend, because it was something she enjoyed so much. So it's something that they look forward to. And then I guess those needs are being met that Sheila was talking about, and it prepares them for learning a little bit.
Yeah, and not only are their needs being met, but it sounds like your needs are being met too. So you're entering the day with a rhythm and a ritual. That's a perfect way to think about it, right? So your level of regulation, you're set up, right? And they're feeding off of that energy that you've created. And what a beautiful way to start the day versus a... let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go. You got to log in, right? I mean, and it's hard. I will be the first to admit that it is not, that schedule in the morning is not, it's not always easy to do. I've had to adjust my own schedule to allow for that to happen, meaning that I have to get up earlier for myself to get my things that I feel like I need to get done. off the table so that I can be present for that. But it it does shift our whole day if we can make that happen. So that was those were beautiful examples.
Lynn, I'm curious to hear about experience.
Yes. Yes. What worked in terms of your learning structure, Lynn?
I didn't reply because I'm pretty sure you have a question on this that's directed specifically at me. Yeah, so I didn't.
Yeah. So it's basically sort of following along with the conversation. Everyone is giving these really awesome tips on how to make this work. And so I guess you actually went through and did all this. And how did your day proceed? And did the learning strategy change as you got older? And what worked for you?
So I actually, right before this meeting, got off the phone with my mother because I wanted to make sure she takes this incredibly seriously to this day. And I wanted to make sure I hit all the points that she felt would really help people. And it was funny because it turned out that what I was like thought would be most important and what she thought were most important were the same thing. So it was like, worked out. And she's actually helping do this again right now with her granddaughter, my niece, who is also distance learning in the mornings. I think last time I checked in, they were doing like little 4-hour sections in the mornings. And by that time they're done. So cause she's five. So then they're homeschooling for the rest of the day. Cause that is a very important distinction that learning at home and homeschooling are not the same things. And honestly, I think a lot of the stuff you get from homeschooling, you can do while you're in school as well. It's kind of a way of thinking more than anything. So there you can apply them differently. But I think it changed wildly over the course of our lives. I say me, it's me and my younger brother. He's 3 years younger than I am. We were both homeschooled our entire lives, very, very deliberately. That was part of before they had kids, my parents, this was going into this, this was a thing they were doing. And my mother was actually able to not work, which, you know, will work for some people, barely worked for us, you know, because it's rough nowadays. But she was able to do that. And that was, you know, that was her job was teaching us. I think when we were kids, kind of what folks have been saying here about ritual and rhythm. Mm-hmm. And that's really important, kind of for the same reason it's important for us right now that, like, if you're working from home right now,
yes.
You know, you cannot come into the day, like, the whole day spread out before me. What will I get up to? Like, you don't want to achieve anything. And I think it adds to that stress. And it's really important, especially if you are completely homeschooling, you have to put something in there. And not like hard and fast, by 8 o'clock, you need to have your shoes on kind of thing, because that will drive you insane. But just kind of like, we need to have breakfast. We need to go for a walk. You need to be outside at some point. At some point, we need to do this. The other thing on that my mother really wanted to stress was, don't panic if stuff does not happen in the order you wanted it to happen in during the day, or if it doesn't happen during the day. Her learning structure was more along the lines of like, we would like to hit all the major subjects during the week and worry more like that, because kids, sometimes you want to do stuff and you just want to do it forever and you don't want to stop. And sometimes you never want to do anything. And in school, stuff is usually split up into the hour. But naturally, is there anything you do 1 hour at a time? Is there anything one kid does for 1 hour and then it's like, I'm done? So if they get into something, that was another like a philosophy with us, which I really appreciated, never realized until I was an adult she was doing on purpose, which is that if we deliberately did anything that was learning, which is, you know, reading a book, pretty much anything but watching TV, she would never stop us because we were, or like, just don't touch them, just let them go. Because the moment someone's like, oh, you're learning, it becomes work. And then you don't want to do it anymore. But if you're self-directing, you retain so much more, you get so much more out of that. And maybe that does mean that instead of like this whole plan you had for the day, it just means you spend 8 solid hours reading about dinosaurs, you know, but by the end of it, you know everything there is to know about dinosaurs and you're going to keep it more. So there was a lot of that. We were very kind of unstructured in that way. And it works differently. Like for me, that works really incredibly well. For my brother, not as much. Sometimes you need to be like, hey, go, you know, maybe we're going to do this next. Maybe we're going to do this. But it works collaboratively, I think, is the big thing. And that really helps too at any age. We would like, it wouldn't be like, okay, you're going to do this next because this is what's good for you. It's more like, what do you want to learn next? Okay, let's move that towards history, you know, or for me, it was let's move that towards mathematics because I absolutely hated math my entire life and I still need to learn it. So that was always kind of a negotiation as to how can we make this fit into this so you don't hate it and, you know, not want to do it, but also that you achieve that. So we would tend to do, like, if I remember correctly, for most of my life, I work better in the morning. I think my brother works better in the afternoon. That was just how we did. But we would, like, get up. We would always have breakfast. That was always, like, part of our ritual. Sometimes it happened a little later, sometimes earlier. But you would have breakfast. And then, you know, we would spend time outside. And sometimes we would go on. I'm so happy to hear about your nature walks. Because that was, that's one of the most vivid things that stuck with me from the ages of, like, you know, 7 or 8 is standing in, you know, in with my wellies on in a stream with a net because you're going to catch stuff and put it under a magnifying glass. Because when you're that age, that's the stuff that sticks with you. I'm sure we were reading about history at that time. I don't remember any of it. Like, but yeah, so it's, and you know, that grows once you become, you know, you start hitting, you know, middle school, teenagerhood, it becomes more of a collaborative process because by that point you're becoming of an age where maybe you know where you want to go. Like you have ideas about the things you want to learn. You know what kind of person you're kind of growing into. But there was a couple of things. I think the most important one we wanted to share was that be calm. Don't freak out. You can, we know for a fact, this was tested on a friend of mine growing up. You cannot do any deliberate learning for years and you will be fine. Especially when you're like between the ages of like 3 and I don't even know, like 12, if you think about it, going to school, how much information you retain from that period, it's not much. And also no person is just going to stop learning. You can't do it. Like no matter what you're doing with your, even if you're self-directing entirely and you're just living your life, you're going to retain information and knowledge, especially at that age. And you're curious, you'll learn stuff. People can't stop you. So if it feels like you've hit the end of a week or a month and that, you know, you didn't hit your goals, or maybe they didn't learn something well enough, don't worry. You can pick it up later. I know people who picked up basic mathematics in college, like you can do it. It's okay. It's very hard to like ruin someone's education. It's much harder than you'd think, but it really helps. It helps you build skills too. When you feel, even when you're, especially when you're small, when you feel like you're being respected enough that you're a collaborator, you're not being talked to, you're involved. I think the big things were always, I guess one of the really big ones is that the time you learn to read, the age that you learn to read is set by the schools is scientifically backed by nothing. You can learn to read at any age. It does not in any way impact how fast you will learn to read or how good you will be at it. So both me and my brother, the resources were there for us to learn when we felt ready to do it. I don't think either of us learned until we were, I think I learned when I was 8. I didn't learn to read till I was 8. I'm a librarian now. I'm one of the fastest readers I know. I've won awards for my writing, so it doesn't impact. And actually, I think it can be a beneficial thing because if you are forced to, you know, if you're forced to learn something, you go into it kind of, you want to fight it. Someone told you to do this. You don't enjoy it. It's a chore. If it is something that is given to you, you have learned to do this yourself, you're going to value it more. And it means that you value reading. At the same time, though, this does put kind of a pressure on the teacher because our rule in our house was always, if someone brought, if I wanted to read a book read to me, it got read to me. You would go up to a parent and I know for a fact sometimes this is debilitating because it means, you know, if you're a parent, you're doing something, you're, you know, putting away dishes or you're on the phone. And sometimes you're just like, I gotta go. You're like, I'm gonna read this book right now. So it works, but it does provide added stress there, but it pays off in the end. But we would read voraciously. And I think it is true of both my brother and I, we did not learn to read ourselves until we hit the point where we were consuming words at a rate that was impossible to keep abreast of. We had audiobooks on our tape deck. I'm not that old, but we had our tape player and it hit the point where we couldn't speed it up fast enough to hear the words at the rate you would reading. And I think that was the point where both of us were like, I'm just going to do it myself. And, but by then I think within a year we were reading Harry Potter to ourselves. Like it's, you learn very fast when you need to. So a lot of it is just self-directed, because you pick up weird skills that way. But the other thing was, this was also kind of a rule, was like, whatever you as an adult are doing, try to make it accessible to kids. Like if you are, you know, cleaning the dishwasher, if you're balancing a checkbook, there's always something in there that a kid can help with, even if it is just like, I'm going to, you know, add numbers on the calculator, I'm going to hold plates for you, something like that. And those skills really stick around and they really make a difference, especially when you do something like go to college. I think we were better prepared for college, like going into it, than most people I know who come out of traditional school, because the learning in high school is so different from in college, because in college you're self-motivated. No one's ever going to double check that you did your homework every day. Like you have to do it. You have to want it. And if you're coming from a background where you've already been encouraged to find your own answers and kind of build your own schedule and tailor things to work for you, you're just much better prepared right off the gate. And it also means that you're able to confront things that you don't know more, because you're not used to people telling you. Like if I find something, I don't know, this stood out to me a lot in freshman year, when something went wrong, I'd be like, oh, okay, like I'm going to Google it. If I can't find Google, I might look on YouTube. If I can't find that, I'll ask my mom. Like, we'll get through all this. And she got hundreds of text messages about stupid things. Like, what do I do when I lock myself out of my apartment? You know, but it was okay, because this was the same kind of a relationship we'd always had. And you learn, you know, you learn, construct and grow. Whereas other people I know who like locked out of their apartment, I watched this happen once. She sat down on the ground and started crying because she had no idea what you do in that situation, because it had never come up before. So I think that skill is just encouraging, you know, if you don't know something, tell your kid you don't know it and go, okay, I don't know this. We're going to find out together. That builds so much trust. And yeah, that's just a collaborative process. So an answer, a very, very long answer to that question. Our days, I think, look differently all the way through. Some days, I know that we have photographic proof. There was one day where my brother, I don't know what happened. He was always an angry kid. He was always a very upset little person. And there was one day where he just got into the paints, and there's this picture of them out in the yard with him head to toe in paint. And apparently, I don't know if it was planned or not, but my mom was like, okay, we're doing this. And we got some paper, and there's these wonderful pictures of him just slathered in paint, like just trashing the yard and dancing and stuff. He had a great time, you know, and that builds something. But I don't know if that was something they were planning to do that day. It just happened.
Quickly pulled out the Jackson Pollock book.
Yeah, exactly what happened. Yes, I think it was like, okay, you're doing this on a wall. Here's some paper. Let's keep going. You know, I know my niece is incredibly self-directed, in the same kind of way where like she gets into something and she's like, okay, I'm going to be the world expert in this within the next 2 days. Like we're going to do this, which can be kind of hard for an adult because you don't necessarily want to learn everything there is to know about unicorns in 24 hours, but you know, it's just part of life. So that I feel like even if you are working with a structured school, like, okay, maybe we, you know, from 8 to 4 or 8 to 3 or whatever, we do this thing. There's ways to kind of do that and make that a part of your day and then extend it and be like, okay, what did you learn today? How can you apply that? Because you learn life skills in school, but they're often a lot more abstract, and it really helps to be like, okay, we learned all this arithmetic. What does that mean for me? What does that mean for the food I'm eating? What does that mean for, you know, how many birds I saw today? Whatever. Ways that you can kind of make that part of it really helps, because otherwise it is just something you're kind of fighting. Because I don't know. I'm sure that there's some kids who like learning, but then there's some like, I was one. If you tell me I'm learning, I want to stop. It's happening. I just don't want to know about it. So, but it's that collaborative process and trusting that, like, whether they know it or not, every kid, every child, every person, your brain wants to get smarter. It's what it's for. You're just going to learn, and that it takes a lot of the pressure off. You don't have to force anyone to do anything. They're going to get there eventually.
When I think your perspective is so valuable, and I think, so I just have to, and this is a subject for a whole different panel discussion, so maybe we'll do it. But I think what you're saying, some of the stuff you're saying about collaborative learning or intrinsic motivation or you know, following the lead, or like you said, your mom sounds awesome, how she would say, you know, we don't know this, so let's Google it. That actually can happen in school too. So and it's harder because, like you talked about, the pressure to learn to read. And, you know, as we all know about the Finnish schools, kids in Finland don't start school until they're seven. So they're not expected to read until they're seven. And most reading experts say if a child at like 8 or 9 is still having trouble reading, there might be an issue there. But a child at 5 who doesn't know how to read, it's probably okay. So some of your comments are speaking also to some of the issues that schools encounter as well. But I think what you were saying is so relevant to all of our discussion about homeschooling, but also could be applied to really good teaching in any setting. So Jennifer, yes, that brings me to my question for you, because you've done both. So you've homeschooled, but at certain points your kids have also gone to school. So how has that transition been? Like, sometimes you've had kids at home where you're homeschooling them, and then at the same time you're helping them with their homework from school. And, you know, is it hard to make that transition back and forth?
No, because every kid was kind of doing what was best for them at that time.
Nice.
So when I had, sometimes I was homeschooling 2 of my daughters and 2 were in school, or 3 of my daughters and 1 was in school, and everybody was in a place where they needed to be. And sometimes if we knew, so for instance, the first time we homeschooled, it was, you know, I was nervous to commit and just kind of say, yes, we're in it for 12 years, like Wynn's family. It was something I always wanted to do, but I didn't have the same confidence that Wynn's mom had. So I said, we'll just do it for a year and we'll, you know, go back to school, see how it goes, go back to school. So in that instance, I stayed in pretty close contact with the school. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, I looked at what the kids would be learning in their grade level had they been going to school. And I kind of stuck with that curriculum or those topics. I didn't feel necessarily wedged. I have to do it the way they're doing it, when they're doing it, how they're doing it, because that was the whole purpose of stepping out of school, was to do it our way. So, but I just kind of made sure that I kept up with the topics and the course of study. But when you're homeschooling, you have so much more time to interject so much more, because you're not waiting for 25 other kids. It's just the 2 kids or the 3 kids or the 4 kids or however many kids are at home to get the subject done. And there's more time for kids to go in depth in topics that they're super interested in. So we were able to very easily cover what was going on in school, plus put our own spin on it and add our travels into it and take, I mean, we were so lucky to live in Virginia and homeschool, where we have amazing field trips within 2 hours. So we were able to do a ton of really hands-on experiential things in addition to the book work that was going on that their peers were doing. So just kind of, you know, for anybody who really is thinking, oh, I want to homeschool, it doesn't mean if you make that decision for mm-hmm. 1 year that you have to do it forever. You do it as long as it works for everybody, mm-hmm. And your situation. And you just kind of, you know, stay in touch, keep in touch with the teachers. Mm-hmm. So I would kind of email the teachers occasionally and just say, hey, we're doing fractions and I see you're probably doing fractions right about now. How deep are you going into improper fractions? Or, you know, and I try not to bother the teachers too much because we're not their students officially, but just enough for them to know that we're on track and we're doing what you're doing. And when we come back, don't worry, you're not going to have to catch us all up, or we're not going to be a burden or a weight. We're going to be right there. So I think that answers the question of just, you know, staying in touch with the school, looking at the studies that they're doing, mm-hmm. and still giving yourself the fun part of homeschooling, which is doing it the way you want to do it, you know, and interjecting what you want to do.
That's great. Yeah, that's, I like how you said it wasn't difficult because it was what was working for your child, each child at the time they were doing it. That's
right.
That's really great. Sheila, at some point, some kids that aren't being homeschooled will be heading back to school. So how can families adapt to that transition, and the kids, the parents, what tips do you have for us about?
Go outside and scream. Go outside and scream and yell. No, I think Jennifer, you just set me up perfectly for that. So this is, and I love that you did that, Jennifer, where you kept in touch with the school and there was an ebb and a flow to what your children needed and what you as a family needed. I would encourage everyone to remember that this distance learning, virtual learning, or whether your child is physically in a building, is a collaboration between the school and the teachers and the staff at the school and you as the parent and your family dynamic, regardless of where your child is actually doing the learning. This should always be, I feel like this opportunity, I'm trying to think of this year and this distance learning, virtual learning, with all of its challenges, I certainly do not want to in any way underestimate the challenges that everyone may be feeling and experiencing. But there's also something really huge to be gained here, which is that this is an amazing opportunity to really re-engage. I know more this year about what my children, my own children are doing, and what the children I work with are doing than I ever have before, because I have to. It's just part of the nature of the beast. My children are checking in with me more often, more frequently throughout the day, even though they're doing their work quite independently. I have access to see what they're doing through these platforms that we're using. So I get to read their actual work and see their actual work. And I think this is just an amazing opportunity to reconnect. I think that should always play a huge role, that this is a collaborative process, that when you send your child into a building, or whether they're in their room virtually learning, or whether you're in the kitchen cooking and learning, a really organic, perfect way to learn, that this is a collaboration. And so what I would encourage families to be doing at this moment in time is making sure that they have a sense of how is their child doing academically. Right? In the schools, this is a bit different than the homeschooling. We are on there is a more of a schedule and a system of tracking. And that's just the nature of this, the way we do things. Where is your child? How are they functioning socially, emotionally? How are they functioning at home? Does it look the same at school? Now you're in a really great position to see and to question these things and to wonder, how does the teacher get them to do this? But you know, they're balking here. Probably it's probably not as different as you think. And how are they in terms of their academic track? Where, how are they doing? And while everybody is super, super, super busy, I'm hearing a lot of from clients, a lot of, well, I don't want to bother. Everyone's getting into this rhythm. And that is true. And I want to honor and respect and validate that. At the same time, we are also advocates for our children and advocates for their process of learning and advocates for that potential upcoming transition. And we can only do that successfully if we have a good grasp on how our child is really doing. And even making the decision, right? The next decision is going to offer hybrid. It's going to offer this option of going in and then being home, but you can also still opt to be virtual. And so thinking about, is it best to have a big transition at this point in the year, or is it better to stay the course for my child, for my individual child, right? And that's going to be very different for everybody. Is my child gaining as much academically? What is their teacher seeing when they're in their synchronous learning opportunities? How are they doing with the executive function skills of time management and getting their work in? Are they engaged? You know, thinking about all of those pieces as we move. I mean, these are big, huge decisions that are bearing. I mean, the weight on our shoulders as we're trying to navigate this is huge. And I think that really making sure that you're collaborating with the teacher, sending an email, having a phone call, having a conference, being respectful of their time. Jennifer, you know, you put that so perfectly. You tapped into a resource that's in our community that you knew that they were beholden to their own students, perhaps, but you were also able to say, hey, we're still here and here's what we're working on, and we value what you bring to the table. And we want to, you know, make sure that we're in the ballpark, right? And I think that parents need to be doing that with their children's their children's teachers. You know, if your kid is doing great and they're being successful and all is well, awesome. Maybe just checking into you with your teacher, you know, is that what you're observing as well? I'm observing my child seems very engaged and they're learning a lot. Or if you're struggling. And this might also involve outside of the classroom teacher. Lots of children this year were assigned to new teachers who are just getting to know them, but they have a history at the school, unless they're young and maybe they don't have a history. So I'm not speaking to those, but many of these children have a history at the school. So tapping into those reasons, how was my child doing last year? Mm-hmm. Is what I'm seeing matching that? Are they keeping up? What should they be doing? If they're having a hard time doing it through the virtual modality, how could I translate that to something more functional and see, are they still grasping that concept? And I love when you spoke to this about the sort of organic opportunities for learning. I love the example of cooking, because cooking is the perfect place to be practicing math skills and direction following skills and language and some reading, even some pre-reading skills, problem solving skills. All of these things happen in the kitchen. So if your child's struggling with doing their math in the seesaw program that has been assigned, maybe there's a way to translate that into something else so that you can check in and see, and then share that with the teacher. Hey, I noticed that they struggled here, but I'm noticing in the kitchen, they're holding on to that information in a different way. Or do you have recommendations as a teacher for some ways I can translate that into things we do every day or on a nature walk or outside while they're riding their bike? How can we translate these skill sets and check in to see how they're doing? So I think that for me would be my big message, is start collaborating now. This is our chance. Yeah. And it's a beautiful opportunity. It's actually not a negative, and it can be a real positive to go, hey, this is kind of cool. I am really engaged in this process for my child.
Thank you, Sheila. That's great.
I have an addition here, because I absolutely love what you're saying. And you mentioned too at the beginning, I feel like with the collaboration thing, if there's one thing you can, like, homeschooling thing you can take away from this year, it is to try and make yourself not just involved, but like make yourself a resource for your kid. Mm-hmm. That I know.
Yes.
I know my best friend growing up did exactly what you're doing, Jennifer, with your kids. He was in and out of school. And that was the one thing that like made such a huge difference, is whether or not, even when he was in school, his mom was always, and his dad, but his mom was always this resource. So if there was a thing he did in school, she was always involved. But if there's a thing he was doing in school, or there's a thing he wasn't doing, he felt comfortable. And you know, same with us, like we felt comfortable being like, I would like to know more about this, and being comfortable to come to a parent and say, I want to know more about this. And kind of making, not only just making yourself available, but making sure that your kid knows nothing is stupid. There's no wrong thing. And it is always okay to get obsessed with this very, very strange thing that has nothing to do with anything else and might not be learning, or, you know, I don't, you know, it doesn't necessarily fall under something, you know, academic, but it that stuff, not only does it enforce that, and it makes you a resource, and it makes you trustworthy. It makes you a friend and an ally. Also, that stuff will come back up in the weirdest ways further down the road. Mm-hmm. And it makes a really huge difference, and it gives, and it honestly gives kids a leg up. Like if you're coming against, you know, folks that are coming from this, everybody has the same traditional background. If you're the one person who got really obsessed with Greek mythology for about a year there, it does make a difference. And it does give you an edge later on. You know, and it's fun, but also, but yeah, that if there's one thing you can hold on to, it's making sure that you're not just, you know, the parent, and you're not just asking about what they're learning. You're saying, okay, why was that cool? What did you like? You know, can I give you more? How can I support this?
Right. Yeah. I'm hearing from all of you about, Sheila, how you said this is an opportunity, and when you're talking about, you know, encouraging, you know, your child to come to you with questions, and Jennifer, you're talking about that. All of you are talking about sort of what I'm hearing a little bit is just the joy. I mean, just the sense that, you know, this really is an opportunity. And if you as a parent can kind of, and it's hard to just say, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect, and we, you know, but just expressing the simple joy of learning, of how fun it can really be to learn. So when you do that, then your kid wants to learn, and then everything, I think, probably gets a little bit easier. But one of the things with the virtual learning is that you are in front of a screen, which, you know, we've all heard about how that's an issue. So Maggie, how do you do a lot of nature stuff with the kids. So how do you deal with incorporating nature away from a screen into your learning?
For us, it comes into being very intentional in, mm-hmm. in building it into our daily schedule or even our weekly schedule, and making it, I mean, for us, it's a priority. Okay. So like I mentioned, part of our morning ritual is usually getting the kids outdoors for independent play, but also our family walk. So for us, we have had, pre-COVID at least, we built into our schedule a regular day for a nature study. And then this was just 2 hours in the afternoon once a week where we followed loosely a nature study curriculum. But often the educational piece where I'm teaching that, you know, that took like 10, 15 minutes. And the rest of the time was exploring in the woods or different environments. And I would try to tie in to whatever we were learning. But a lot of the times it was just like the kids enjoying being outside. It became something that they really looked forward to. And then they started to apply a lot of what we were learning anyway on their own. So getting off track, but really for us, it's been making it very intentional. So in our house, we do limited screens, which we have the luxury, the privilege of doing that as being homeschoolers. But I think even as parents who have to support their children in virtual learning, setting certain boundaries or guidelines, like, okay, once we're getting off the screen, and this may be, again, having to kind of rearrange your schedule, but making a time that when that computer closes, like you're going to go for a walk for as a family, mm-hmm. or as a, you know, picking that one day a week where you have an afternoon where you can go to one of our many wonderful nature areas and just go and let your kids be a kid. Your kids, even older children, are teenagers, getting them outside and walking. And just kind of a lot of what we do is, you know, if there needs to be some prompting, there is some, but a lot of the times it's following their lead and helping them remember, oh, hey, I love, like, being outside is great. And something that I do a lot with my kids to kind of like help strengthen that connection is we talk about how they feel when they're outside. And we don't do this like daily, but it's built into our regular kind of conversation to kind of encourage them to check in with themselves. And so that they start making that connection of, oh yeah, you know, like I felt less stressed when I was outside, or like it really energized me and I feel more peaceful when I'm in the woods, which in my experience has naturally kind of supported my children in wanting to be outside and not asking to be on screens all the time. And it's something that they look forward to, and they start doing more on their own, more independently. So we have our schedules and our time where we're doing it as a family, or I'm doing it with them. It's been working towards getting them to realize how much they get out of being in the outdoors.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And then, I mean, for homeschoolers, there's so many programs that build in learning in the outdoor setting. So like even like learning math through, we don't use this program, but there's one called Wild Math and it's all outdoors and nature based. And I think for people who were virtual learning as well, like being able to use some of those little programs if they want to support. And I'm more familiar with like younger kids sort of stuff, but if you know your child is working on addition, there's really simple ways for when you're outdoors and they're playing and collecting acorns and being able to incorporate that learning and supporting that learning kind of organically while helping them make the connection away from screens.
Right. That's awesome. That's great.
Can confirm that works.
Wonderful.
It works very well.
I think another quick thing for screens too is, I was thinking about this when Sheila was talking about we can't make kids focus, but we can definitely meet their needs so that they're ready to focus and buy, like Wynn said, buying into the focus. And one of the things that worked, just a little practical little tip that worked really well for me with my girls is if somebody was hitting a wall or they just weren't ready, sometimes I would say, let's play a game. You know, or we'll play, how about this? We'll play a game and then we'll start our math, or we'll take a break from our math because everybody's getting whiny and tired or not into it or whatever. How about if we take a break and we'll play this game and then we'll go back to our math or read or history or whatever it is. And just having lots of those quick, there's a game called the Clumsy Thief that practices counting number families to 100. It's a super easy 15-minute game. You can play several rounds. It's super fast. It's still kind of educational. When they don't know they're learning, they're having lots of fun. So just kind of having a lot of quick, easy games on hand that are still, as a mommy, you feel good. You're not stressed out because you're still doing work. You're still learning. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not panicking because you're doing something educational. And the kids are getting that break and learning fairly seamlessly. So just kind of having a few things that, or listening to, I mean, I'm still stuck in the age of CDs. I know everybody else is on to Audible and all of that, but I'm back with my CD player. And, you know, just having like, let's listen to a quick story first, or let's take a break and listen to a quick story, and then we'll go back to what we're doing. Yes. So kind of just having a few resources. And JMRL has amazing resources for that and amazing librarians who can give you suggestions for those kinds of things. Just kind of a reset button, you know, if you will.
Yeah.
So maybe for days when you can't get outside, because getting outside is, of course, the supreme reset. So as Maggie is mentioning in Wynn too. But for those days that it's raining or sleeting or mucky and yucky, then just having something really quick at your fingertips that you can reset from the screen.
Right. Thank you. That's awesome, Jennifer. Thank you.
Yeah. Can I chime in there since we're throwing out some good, I love those, all of those tips for kids who maybe their parent can't stop to play a game, or, you know, maybe the scheduling doesn't work out. I'm going to promote sensory bins.
Yes.
Sensory bins are an awesome way for kids of a wide, you know, often we think of that for little kids, for younger kids, but kids of all ages love, and you can modify, but having a fun bin with Play-Doh and some materials to make monsters, you know, some sort of invitation to something that engages them in a very different way than being on the screen, you know, filling up a bin with unpopped, you know, with popcorn kernels, and putting things in and engaging their other senses. And then having them do a check-in, I love that. Maggie, you know, we're setting kids up for huge lifelong success if we can model ourselves and also teach them to check in with themselves and notice, how did that make you feel? And even if they're initially reticent, as they move through whatever, you know, whether they're outdoors or playing a game with you or doing a sensory bin or making something, that whatever it may be that's away from the screen, and checking in on those things. So there's lots of great options here for ways to have kids come off. And for many kids, it does have to be super intentional. Because of just the way that screen takes over. But for many kids, it also is, they are looking forward to getting off of the screen. And we as adults can also model that. You know, now we're living in a world, I was never in front of a screen pre-COVID, ever, ever. And now I'm sitting in front of a screen huge chunks of the day and realizing that, wow, I need to get up and move and step outside and leave. And so modeling that for ourselves. And sometimes that means I only have 5 minutes to do it. Sometimes it means I have longer, but we are falling victim to that as well. Yeah. And so we as adults are in the perfect position to not only model the behavior, but to notice and comment and add the layer of language to that. And again, the long-term outcome of that is going to be fabulous, because when kids are insightful into their own nervous system and level of regulation, they are better prepared to tackle things down the road. So
I think it's worth, I'm so happy you said that, because I think that now is a life skill. And when I was in like growing up as a kid, it wasn't yet, because we didn't have tablets. And I do the same thing now. It is possible for me to sit still for 8 hours staring at a computer, and then about 6 hours in, I'm like, what is happening? My work is suffering. My head hurts. My shoulders are up here. And I'm having to like set alarms on my phone that are like, go outside. And all you have to do is go stand in the yard and look at the tree for 5 minutes and then come back inside. And so I think that this is another example of one of those things where that's like, by doing that intentionally now, that's going to help your kid for the rest of their life, because they'll know, you know, when they start to get, it's starting to happen, you know, that your instant reaction to this is like, okay, step up, do something else, you know, get something further away from your face than, you know, a couple of feet. That's, yeah, I think that's a really important thing to do.
Well, Wynn, I was going to ask you, we don't have very much time left. So if you could just tell us very briefly, so you were homeschooled your entire life. So what are the nuts and bolts then? And again, it has to be very briefly about how you went ahead then and were able to apply to college and do all of that without, you know, the high school diploma.
The great thing.
You have a high school diploma, how you did all that without the,
The great thing about this is it's actually gotten a lot easier. When we were growing up, there was a question for a little while there. Like, we knew it could happen, but it was going to be rough. Mm-hmm. In some states, it still is. Some states, I don't know if Virginia is one, will require you, if you are going cold turkey homeschooling, there are usually some tests or things you're required to pass. They're usually pretty simple, fairly easy to prep for, but make sure you know that ahead of time, what you're looking for. But also, don't get stuck on the idea of, like, I have to do this and this and this to get to this point. Mm-hmm. People get into college all kinds of different ways. I got in one way, my brother does it a different way. I know people who've done it other ways. Use your resources is the big thing. It's very easy to kind of feel like an island out here. There are thousands and thousands of families across the United States and the world that homeschool. They do it for billions of different reasons. I know some of, like, we had a homeschooling group when I was growing up, and it was fantastic because there's other parents, there's other resources. Everyone knows different things. So you can kind of pool your knowledge, but also you get to see that I'm in the same group with, you know, Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and, you know, hippies and everybody and people who, you know, parents traveled for work, so school wasn't an option. So just wildly different backgrounds. I got into school kind of two different ways. I do have a high school transcript. We made it at home. It kind of takes all this amorphous stuff and tries to make it look like a transcript. Whether or not it got me into anything, I couldn't tell you. I also took a couple of standardized tests. I took the PSATs, but I have never taken the SATs or any of graduate tests. I hit a point as an adult where I started avoiding them on purpose to see if I could. You can. but the best, honestly, the best way, if you were just terrified, you don't know what to expect, get a GED. It never hurts. It's really simple. The test is now actually is much more equitable and accessible, and honestly is better than it was a couple of years ago. They just did another. It's never a bad idea to have one. I actually don't. I got around it all on my own. Another thing you can do, what I did was I started taking part-time courses at a community college. at the lowest age they would allow, which was 15. And it was just a couple of courses. Usually what they'll do, they don't always require, some of them would prefer you have a GED, but most of them are going to give you an assessment test, which puts you into, you know, maybe you need some English or math. I don't think I've met a single homeschooler that has ever tested into anything less than advanced placement, because we, you know, you already did all this stuff. But it just, you know, then you'll take a couple of composition courses, and just having 6 college grade lit credits will get you so far, because you have that transcript.
That's great advice. That's great.
Yes. And if you have a school, this was the other step. If you have a college you want to transfer into, make sure you have a really good handle on what their transfer needs are, because usually if you have a certain number of college courses, that's all they want, and they don't want anything from before that. They don't care where you came from. So if you can hit that level, that'll get you in everywhere. Yep.
Thank you. Thanks to all of you for being here today. I realize we're quickly running out of time, and we could talk on and on and on about this. But I really want to thank everyone who attended and everyone who spoke today and gave us all your great advice. And just a reminder for any needs you have for academic questions or learning needs, make sure to contact jmrl.org or call your local branch, and we're happy to help you. And again, I want to thank everybody and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thank you.
A big thank you to all of the panelists and to Anne for moderating. They shared a lot of useful information, and we're glad to be able to share their conversation with you now. As Anne mentioned, this and many other virtual programs have been recorded and are available on our YouTube page. We'll link to our YouTube page and to the video of this particular panel in our show notes.
At the time of this recording, JMRL is currently offering contactless curbside pickup for books at all branches, Monday through Saturday, and limited in-person services at some branches. We'll link to further information about hours and procedures in our show notes. Please note that it might take longer than normal for your items to be ready to pick up, so we appreciate your patience while we continue to prioritize the safety and well-being of patrons and staff.
This podcast is made possible through generous support from the Friends of the Library. If you'd like to learn more or join the Friends, please head to their website at jmrlfriends.org. Please hit subscribe wherever it is that you're listening to this podcast. If you have books that you'd like for us to read and discuss, or topics that you'd like to hear on a future episode, please email us at podcast@jmrl.org.
That's all for us today. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more content. Thanks for tuning in, and we're glad to be on the same page.